Hello, my name is Paul Greatrex and welcome to the latest edition of University Registrars and Others talking about stuff, which this time finds me talking to higher education sector data guru Andy Yule. Whilst Andy started his working life at Rolls-Royce working on various aircraft, he soon found the appeal of data and higher education funding irresistible and joined the Polytechnic and Colleges Funding Council just before it merged with its university's counterpart and then became the Higher Education Funding Council for England, or HEFC. He became heavily involved in data collection, and indeed it was his phone number given as the contact for HESI's inquiries. This certainly helped build his data network, something he continued in joining HESA in 1996, the beginning of a long engagement which saw him work on all sorts of exciting data projects, including a three-year stint running a major sector data improvement program, HEDIP, yet another acronym he was involved in. Andy has some excellent insights about the use and misuse of data by both regulators and institutions, and the challenges of data governance and the risks of what is still an immature science. We also talk about learner analytics and the data work Andy is currently doing for his employer, the University College of Estate Management. Finally, we learn about Andy's ongoing part-time rock star lifestyle. He loves drums and music as well as data. And also a little known fact about his enduring data legacy in relation to the origins of the naming of the higher education subject codes we all know and love. It's a great episode and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, welcome everyone. My name's Paul Greatrex and it's my huge pleasure to introduce this time on University Registrars and Others talking about stuff, someone who falls very much into the other category, but could, if history had been different, fall into the first, Andy Yule, who is currently a consultant and data person at large, but has a long track record in different parts of the sector. Welcome, Andy. Great to see you.
Paul, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Well, we're going to talk a bit about your long and august history in higher education and some data stuff as well, no doubt. But let's go back to the very beginning, because you haven't always worked in higher education, have you? Because you started off, I think, in Rolls-Royce. Is that right?
I did. And actually, so after my A-levels, I was fed up with education and I wanted to get out into the world of work. I was fed up with education. I was playing in a rock and roll band and had aspirations in that direction. And I started an apprenticeship with Rolls-Royce, where I did I was working on sort of business statistics around the military engine group business. So we were working with, you know, the RB199 in the Tornado and the Pegasus engine in the Harrier jump jet, and also with the Olympus engine that powered Concorde, because obviously that started life in the Vulcan bomber. So I was sort of immersed in that world of military aviation for 4 years. And then something amazing happened, which was the Berlin Wall came down, and there was a thing called the peace dividend, which actually turned out manifested itself to be a load of cuts in defence spending. So all of a sudden there was a need to find alternative gainful employment. I hadn't reached rock star status by that point, so I concluded I had to go and get another job. So after 4 years working in the military aviation business in Bristol, I was looking through the local paper, and there was this strange organisation that had just relocated from London to Bristol, and it was called the Polytechnics and Colleges Funding Council, and they were looking for assistant statisticians, and I had done the sort of work and used the sort of systems that they were looking for, and got an interview, and I started there in 1991, so gosh, that's 32 years ago now.
Just before the ending of the binary divide as well, and a very interesting time to be joining it. I mean, I guess it was, so PCFC is an acronym that will hold fond memories for many
older listeners perhaps who were around at the time of the binary divide, but it was an organization that didn't last very long after you joined, presumably, and became merged into or part of what was then Hefke. Is that right?
That's right, and indeed, I mean, by the time the relocation to Bristol happened, the planning for the merger was already well underway. And so at the point I joined, there was already, you know, quite a lot of discussion about the merger with UFC. As a part of the relocation, the two organizations had moved into the same building. The first floor was the UFC and the second floor, I think, was the PCFC. And so, you know, we were there in the same building, all getting to know each other. But yes, it was an absolutely fascinating time. One of my first tasks in the autumn of 1991 was to run HESIS, and you know, that was a feature of my life for the following 5 years. And actually, that was very interesting to see how that morphed from the PCFC HESIS into the new HEFC world, and dealing with all of these old universities as well as the new universities. But it was an absolutely fascinating time to be involved with that stuff.
And then, so you joined, or you became part of Hefke, and so HESA was a separate body that you were at that time was entirely separate. When was HESA established then? That was,
yeah. So HESA was but a glint in the eye. HESA did not exist at that point.
Right.
HESA. So there was a thing called HESCOOP, because gosh, we love our acronyms. There was the Higher Education Statistics Coordination Working Party, and that was there to address the question of data and statistics for the post-binary sector, because up until that point, there was the USR, University Statistical Record, that did the old universities. And then there were different arrangements for the polytechnics in the different nations of the UK. And so HESCOOP was this committee that was formed. It was chaired by Mike Sterling, who was at the time the chair of the USR. So there was a sense in which you knew which way it was kind of going to go. And so while we within Northavon House were forming HEFC, there was in Cheltenham this piece of work going on to stand up this new organisation that at the time was going to be called the Higher Education Data Agency.
Right.
And at the very last minute, the newly appointed chief executive, Brian Ramsden, said statistics are far more valuable than data. It has to be HESA. And thus an acronym was born.
Well, I didn't know that. Well, that is interesting. So you were liaising with them while you were at Hefke, and then you joined them. You jumped over to Cheltenham.
I did. And so my early years at Hefke were all about running the HEFC data collection and liaising with HESA and supporting them and helping them stand up, and then those first data collections going through. And that was a fantastic time to be in the sector, because I didn't realise it at the time, but we were laying foundations for the next, you know, two or three decades. And the work I was doing, there was an awful lot of liaison across the sector. Mine was the name and telephone number that was put on the front of the HESIS circular. So I was the person that everyone phoned up or emailed in those days. And that was a really an amazing way to establish a really strong network across the sector.
Yeah.
And I have established, you know, friendships with people who are still in the sector today. Through that work. I mean, there was one chap who was the I think the academic registrar at the University of Hull, who was struggling with his HESIS return, and he is Antonine McLaren, who now runs St Mary's University. So, you know, that there was all that going on. And then, yes, I mean, the move to HESA, I actually jumped ship in 1996. I was spending increasing amounts of time in Cheltenham and got getting to know the organisation very well. And I used to go and do a piece of work around data quality. And that's when things got really interesting.
You'd started off with a bit of data, and then it became more data, and then it became kind of almost all data as you moved into to HESA. I mean, did you, and you know, it has been kind of a lot of data ever since, and we'll come back to the rock ambitions shortly. I guess, did you really, you know, was it the thing in all your working existence that actually you found was the most interesting and stimulating part of work? Or was it just that that was the way that things were going and you were rather good at it, so you thought you'd carry on?
It was probably a little bit of both. I mean, when I was at school, I was very good at maths. I took my maths exams early. I did maths at A level, and you know, so I was always leaning more in that direction. And I mean, yes, the data world I have always found absolutely fascinating. The way that we try and represent the messy, complex realities of the world through the actually fairly blunt tool of data, and there's a whole kind of sort of theoretical and philosophical side to all of that interests me enormously, but actually I just love to sort of build big machines and make these big machines work and see it churn and see it pump, and I find that very satisfying.
Now, I'm just looking at your LinkedIn page here, Andy, right? According to this, right, you were at HESA for 17 years and 4 months, right? That seems like a hell of a time to be with an organisation. I mean, did you feel you'd become part of the furniture there?
Yes and no. I mean, that first stint at HESA, I mean, it was a period of incredible development, both in terms of the data, the systems to support the data, the thinking around data quality assurance, and also the role of data in funding and regulation, which has gone through a complete transformation over the past couple of decades. And so I think the term feeling a part of the furniture perhaps, you know, suggests a rather more leisurely existence. It was always developing. There was always something new. And we did a lot. I mean, we did development work around the data. We did a huge amount of development work around the systems. We moved the whole of the student data to XML in 2007. And you know, that was a huge transformation across the sector. It was wonderful. It was fascinating, challenging, hugely rewarding, and literally never a dull moment. So those years flew by. They actually flew by.
And then you stepped sort of aside from HESA to do HEDIP, didn't you, which is improvement program, and then you went back into HESA. Although I don't think you ever actually left the building, did you? I don't know. Was it like that?
Yes, it was. I mean, HEDIP was never a legal entity. We love our acronyms, HEDIP, the Higher Education Data and Information Improvement Programme. It was never a legal entity in its own right. So it was hosted by HESA. So I actually never left the payroll of HESA. And yes, I retained a little space in the corner of the HESA office for 3 years while we did HEDIP, and then going back to HESA actually just involved me moving desks to a different part of the building.
So, but actually now I add it up, it's a lot longer at HESA, you know, in terms of the building. But I mean, an awful lot of change during that period, right? And I think my perception of it, both as an outsider but also as from a period on the HESA board, was that there were also lots of challenges, right? Because there were a range of external stakeholders, not just the universities, who kept demanding more and more of HESA, which it was, with the best will in the world, as a small organization dependent on subscriptions, didn't have huge resources to fulfill. And it also always felt to me that it was slightly unfair to place such a burden of expectations on HESA. Do you think that's fair?
I think it is, and I think you've actually landed on the key word there, because the key word in all of this is expectations. And you know, what we have seen over the last two decades, as the technology becomes increasingly more powerful and the IT industry wants to sell you all of this aspiration because the technology is more powerful. What we have seen in parallel to Moore's law, we've seen kind of this parallel increase in expectations of the value that can be derived from data. And we see that in the funding and regulatory space. We see it from the PSRBs. We see it from all kinds of stakeholders, the league tables. Everyone now has such enormous expectations of data. And I think where data is now is actually in a very different place from where it was 20 or 30 years ago when I was starting out, because, you know, looking at the sort of history of data and even going back to, you know, the USR and the University Grants Committee and, you know, sort of the older prehistory, data was always kind of there in the background, but it was never at the centre. But there is now, it's now at the centre. Everything is such huge expectations for everything to be data driven. And so, yes, an organisation like HESA now, JISC, is absolutely at the centre of that pressure. But there is also a need, and I think the need is still there because we didn't achieve it with HEDIP. I think there is a need for data to become properly recognised as the valuable strategic asset that it is, rather than a technical thing that lives with the systems.
No, I think that's a hugely important point. And there are two dimensions to that, both of which you've touched on. The first is the demands of the regulator, and they've undoubtedly changed over time as well, and are perhaps more starkly and bluntly expressed than they ever have been before. But the other element to it is what institutions themselves do with their data, as it were. And I mean, you've seen a lot. I mean, what's your? I mean, my perception is that universities are, on the whole, really, really not very good at exploiting the information, the data that they do have, to assist them with strategic decision making. Right? They either get lost in the morass of it, or they're too easily distracted by what looks shiny and high level and persuasive, right? And actually, you need a genuinely intelligent and strategic approach to, you know, developing, sifting and quality assuring, and then defining what you need from your data before you actually decide how you present it. So what's your assessment of where institutions are at? And is it actually very different across the sector? Are there some great examples of institutions that do it really well?
I think, well, as always, the higher education sector is a very diverse sector. And it's diverse in just about every way that you can imagine. And of course, in a sense, that is the great strength of the higher education sector. But the other side of that is that it also brings with it some challenges and some weaknesses. And I think that does manifest itself in the whole conversation around data, both at the sector level and within individual institutions. Because, you know, there is something about what a university is that doesn't sit very comfortably with the idea that one can neatly classify it into category X or category Y of something. And, you know, the business that we're in, you know, higher education, teaching and research, there are elements of this that can be systematically analysed, but there is an awful lot of this that just doesn't lend itself to being neatly classified into data boxes. It is perhaps a bit more fluid, perhaps a bit more mercurial than something that lends itself towards data. So I think data will always be a challenge. You then lay across onto that the fact that many universities, many higher education providers are very old organisations. And you know, there's a huge amount to be celebrated in that, in the heritage and the history and the prestige that goes with that. But none of those attributes are things that lend themselves to be actually a high value data driven organisation, because actually universities are just a bit different. It's probably taken me, you know, 30 however many years and especially the last 5 years working in the sector, it's taken me a long time to really appreciate how well data actually doesn't work in higher education and the reasons for that. And I think there are implications both for institutions, but I think there's also institutions for those who fund and regulate higher education through the medium of data.
Yeah, and I think whilst institutions may come to terms with those challenges and that fluidity that you describe and recognise, you know, their own, you know, the nature of the business they're in and the weaknesses and the loose ends that then provides, regulators are a bit less forgiving, aren't they? And I mean, you know, so I have got in my head, right, a recollection from the very beginning of the days of the Office for Students when the then chair, Michael Barber, was talking about, you know, he wanted what is now called, I think what was called HESA Data Futures at that point. He wanted that to be a kind of real-time dashboard that he, as chair of the OFS, could see daily on his desktop exactly what was going on in the sector, right? And I fear that we are kind of still hamstrung by that vision, right? That concept that things like higher education could actually lend themselves to that kind of what is frankly looks like a railway or a power station dashboard where you can see the megawatts or the trains backing up or whatever it might be. Whereas higher education just isn't like that, right? It's, you know, the checkpoints are, you know, often annual or even in the case of REF, every 5 to 7 years. Yeah, I mean, there are very, very different time series here. And that dream, though, has kind of coloured everything since, I think.
Well, it has. And I share a lot of that analysis. I don't think higher education is alone in this. I think, you know, what we're describing here is something that is more broadly the mindset now across government, across regulators, that, you know, data is the answer. And you know, an awful lot of a lot of people have drunk a lot of Kool-Aid, haven't they, about the data. You know, they've really bought into that. I think there are huge challenges, and I think we are now, and I've said this quite openly, I've written about this previously. I think we are now in a situation where the OFS are trying to drive an amount of value out of the data that the data will not support. And there is something about the extent to which the sector is incredibly diverse and the extent to which the data models that are used at a national level are relatively very, very simple. And there's a huge amount of shoehorning that goes on to fit this diverse, complex reality into these very simple data models. And what the OFS see, you know, through the lens of those data structures, is something that sometimes masks an awful lot of complexity and nuance that they just have no visibility of. And then when they're trying to drive the amount of value out of the data that they are, I think there is a weakness there because they're disconnected from the reality. They only have this very neatly managed, curated lens through which they look at the data, and the absence of effective governance over the analysis, I think, leaves them in quite a difficult position and particularly exposed. And obviously they've fallen over once with the case of the Bloomsbury Institute, which was effectively an absence of governance over their data activities. I saw a similar thing in the review of the 2020 exams, the A-levels, O-levels shambles that I was involved in. When we reviewed that, we saw an absence of governance over data analysis and data processing activities. And of course, this is all new because data processing on this scale and complexity is relatively new, and the world is still trying to come to terms with what good looks like in this space. But I think there are huge risks for the sector and for the regulator. And the risks for the regulator, are we really clear about this, the risks for the regulator are both in terms of false positives and false negatives. So the risks that they will not identify stuff that is bad, and the risks that they identify as bad stuff that is not, and I think it will fail in both directions.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with all of that, Andy. There are some real elephant traps in all of this that we need to be wary of. Thinking about it from a different angle, from the institutional perspective, I mean, you rightly identify the risks of poor or absent governance in relation to this. I mean, it's something that institutions as well have, I think, run into difficulty with from time to time, particularly when they're trying to use data in relation, an analysis of data in relation to student performance and students at risk, right? You know, using, you know, a small number of data points to identify students who may be at risk. And then, as you say, in the same way as doing it at a sector level, identifying people wrongly on the basis of that. And that creates real angst amongst the student body and student representatives who see it as an invasion of privacy. But also it creates concern that actually you just end up missing a load of people because you're relying on the data instead of, you know, judgment and, you know, systems for observing people and other ways of picking up this. So what's your take on universities' use of data for that purpose?
So, I mean, it's remarkably difficult because of all of these complex and non-data friendly factors that get involved in this kind of thing. I mean, certainly in the sort of learner analytics space, there is a hugely important thing around governance and ethics of the whole endeavor, and I know, you know, universities that have done a lot of learner analytics work have you know taken the sort of governance and the ethics side very seriously. I know JISC has some very good resources around sort of governance and ethics of this thing. I think the universities themselves are obviously in a better place to do this because they understand their reality, and therefore they understand how their reality is mapped into the data. And so if you are then trying to analyse the data to tell you something about your reality, they are better placed to do that than the funders and regulators who are you know a long, long way from all that. But the reality is, you know, this is still a relatively immature science. We have only had data processing capabilities like this for the past decade or possibly two. And of course, Moore's Law, which tells us that our computers become twice as powerful every 18 months. Moore's Law does not apply to organizations, and it does not apply to the human beings that make up those organizations. And so while there is all of this aspiration about data, about how fast and big and fantastic and flashy it is because the technology is now so powerful, we are still the same human beings that we were, you know, thousands of years ago, and organizations haven't really evolved that much in recent years as well. And so I think generally there is a huge challenge about the expectations running away beyond our capabilities.
And part of what you're doing now, I assume, and you've got a portfolio of exec and non-exec roles, but you're also doing consulting as well, is I assume helping universities deal with all of these issues that we've discussed.
Since leaving HESA, I was freelance working with a number of universities and a number of software providers as well as doing sort of writing and speaking things. For the last couple of years, I've been working with the University College of Estate Management, and I'm working with them exclusively at the moment. And you know the challenges are there, and you know we have challenges around the use of data, the management of data, the governance of data. I think we're doing it pretty well. Perhaps I would say that, wouldn't I? You know, I think we are doing it well. But I'm in doing this, I am, you know, every day I am learning so much about higher education and the relationship between higher education and data. So I mean, yes, I'm on a bit of a personal crusade with this, I think.
Good. And you mentioned earlier your rock star ambitions. Now, I haven't seen pictures that you post on social media of you sitting behind your drum kit, usually on a Friday evening. I mean, I'm assuming that still hasn't quite taken off yet, but you've got enough to keep you interested. So how's that going?
I'm doing that stuff as much as I want now. I have young family, and I have full-time job, but I play in a rock band. playing around Gloucestershire and the area, and we're out, you know, two or three times a month. I play in a jazz quartet, so I get to do some of that more cool stuff, playing jazz, which I absolutely love. And I also, you know, in my more geeky moments, I spend my evenings and weekends restoring old drum kits, locked away in the garage, surrounded by bits of drums, and I'm always, you know, surrounded by them. My study here is full of drums, under the desk and on shelves and everywhere. So, you know, that's still very much a part of my life. But, you know, I love drums and music, and I do data, and that's me.
Fantastic, thank you, Andy. Before we wrap up, I mean, you've been, as you mentioned, around in higher education for well over 30 years now. What's the give us one nugget, one interesting fact that you've picked up about higher education, or indeed, you know, been involved in that people might not know?
So many stories. Many of which I probably shouldn't tell. Okay, here's one. Shortly after I joined HESA in 1996, those early years of the HESA data collections, also in Cheltenham, obviously PCAS and UCCA came together to form UCAS, and we were both organisations were using subject coding systems that looked very similar but were a little bit different because of various historical reasons. And so a team of four people were assembled to create a subject coding system that both HESA and UCAS could use. And those four people were two from HESA: Jonathan Waller, who's actually still with HESA, myself, Andy, and then there was a chap called Clive from UCAS, and a lady called Sarah. And Jonathan, Andy, Clive and Sarah became known as the Jacks Group to create a new subject coding system for higher education. And we were so successful that when we published the new subject coding system, it became known as Jacks. We found a new set of words to fit the acronym, which is Joint Academic Coding System. But I shall forever dine out on the idea that I am actually the A in Jacks.
Well, that's and, you know, live on, therefore, whatever happens in higher education, legend as part of the Jacks coding system. Oh, that's a real source of pride. That's fantastic. Now, listen, Andy, thank you so much for the chat. It's been really great talking to you and learning a bit about your history, but also about talking about data in higher education. It's been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.